Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome back hypnotherapist, author, and all-around compassionate soul, Mr. Ivan Rose. Ivan, welcome back, my friend.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, man, we're so excited to have you back. When I saw your email came in, I was like, whoa, what does Ivan want? And he's like, well, he's going to be back and wants to be on the show. I couldn't have been more grateful to get that email.
Thank you.
So I understand that you've been pretty busy since we've last spoke. Mm-hmm. You come out of the gate with that. You've written three books, and I want to get to them. But I want you to kind of give us a little bit of a flyover with the app and some of the things that you've been doing mm-hmm. that these books are building on.
Mm-hmm. The app's been a work in progress. There's always things to change, things to improve. So I sort of pulled back the release of the app for a while to make a few changes. So that's going really well. Had a lovely write-up in the newspapers back home in the UK about it. So that's all singing and dancing now. And it's ready and available for teenagers, youngsters to download and have some help and assistance with their mental health.
And what was the impetus for doing that?
Well, I realized that teenagers, if you help teenagers, you save the adult. Mm. You know, if somebody's had a difficult upbringing, for instance, or they're more impulsive and emotional type of people, then the app is really important to them because, you know, adolescence is a, you know, it's a time of life when anything can happen. You know,
right.
You're forming. And you can help them at that stage and improve them so much quicker than you can as they become an adult. Once they become an adult, you know, because I think the thing is with children, generally, they live in the present moment, don't they? So, you know, they recover at the drop of a hat. So once they get to puberty, once that starts to change, that changes too. And they become more affected by things, you know, rejection and all. And nowadays we've got, you know, cyberbullying, there's peer pressure. There's so many more things than there was when I was young. There's more social media has a massive impact on the mental health of teenagers. And so I felt that it's needed very much. And I worked on a practice, I may have said to you before, I worked on a practice where people were bringing teenagers to me. And I realized then, and I think it's just evolved, Eric, it's just evolved over time. And as I said, I just wanted to get people to have a better adulthood, basically.
Do you find that people have a more difficult time making a 180 as adults because of a physical component to their neuroplasticity or just habit forming or things like that? Or do you think it's more, or do you feel that it's more in line of just the youth is just more malleable in life in general because experience hasn't boxed them in yet?
I think it depends on their personality types. You know, some people are thicker skinned than others. Some people are more sensitive and they're much more likely to be affected. Whereas someone that's thicker skinned would just sort of brush it off and move on. But definitely we become more conscious about our physical presence, our looks, our image, our dress, you know, as teenagers, without doubt, that's a massive factor.
What do you think, this social media aspect, I don't want to grind on this too much, and I didn't really anticipate talking about it, but do you feel like there is a positive that can be gleaned from it? I mean, I don't want to date myself, but I remember being around when MySpace first came out, and it was so much more like communal, and it took a while for it to be nasty and become Facebook and all these things. Do you feel that there's any kernel of goodness in social media that with a different perspective, teenagers of today and tomorrow could make better, more communal use of? Or do you think we're kind of on a one-way street if this is just as toxic as it's going to be and as beneficial as it's going to be and we just got to navigate that?
Well, I think, you know, society has changed. Like children used to go out and play. They'd be out on their bike. They'd be playing in the parks. They'd meet their friends.
Guilty.
So now, me too. So now they're not doing that. They're staying home. And they're communicating online. So there is a need for it, absolutely. Otherwise, there's no communication at all. But of course, in real life, you have bullies and you get them online. And in a way, it's easier for people to be horrible online, isn't it, or nasty online, because they can hide behind the mask of, you know, of the social media. They can even make false IDs and things, you know. So it's, you know, it's like everything in life. You know, it's six of one, half dozen the other. It's got some good points and it's got some negatives too.
Do you think that we'll be able to have more of a a standpoint in society where we can maximize the positives? Or you like I said, do you think that we're just at the point where we got to navigate the wash of it's now just developed to as bad as it is and as good as it is?
I think it's very similar. I think people just have to learn the ropes. I think people just have to recognize, you know, toxicity and recognize things that are positive. And in real life, you know, you'd stay away from someone that was not negative or toxic or a bully. And I think on social media, it's got to be the same.
Right.
So I don't think it's, I just think that the media of it's changed. Same situation, but on a different level. But of course, with social media, everyone's so accessible. You know, if you were a kid that played outside, for instance, you're only accessible by the people around you. Whereas now, people can reach far and wide. But it's, you know, it's great for things like for this, self-promotion. It's great for, you know, for learning. There's a lot of pluses, I think, to social media too.
Amen, yeah.
But there needs to be a lot of rules around it. So it needs to be policed, doesn't it? It needs to be, people need to be accountable for their actions like they would be on the streets.
Yeah, and that's what I was just going to say. It's strange to strange to navigate that accountability when there's no physical connotation to it. You know what I mean? And I have a son, he's just about to turn 15. He was the youngest of the three kids I've raised, and he got video games first, at a younger stage than the other two, because I came to the realization that this was the only way that he could communicate like I used to, playing with my friends. So what are some of the things that you feel are essential when you got a teenager that's getting into these waters and you know you can't sit there and hawk over their shoulder? You got to try to give them some ways to navigate the road. What are some of the things that you think are crucial about navigating this landscape?
I think you've got to educate them. I think you've got to teach them some of my thinking rules. You've got to teach them to not take things personally. You've got to teach them to stay away from people they don't know. I think would be great for social media for youngsters is, you know, is to say to them, well, if you don't know the person, you shouldn't be communicating with them, because you don't know who that person is. And so I think social media needs to be shrunk a bit. So it's just around, you know, so for instance, if someone's got a Facebook group and it's just for their family, amazing, right? Close people, close friends, close family. So perhaps what needs to happen, a lot of social media, it needs to go like that. So they have groups where those groups, you know, and the people vote the people in or allow the people to join.
Right.
And that would work really, really well. But of course, like anything, isn't it? When it's open, wide open, it's just a recipe, isn't it, for negativity or problems or disaster. And of course, there's lots of other negativities, isn't there, with social media? There's grooming, there's this type of thing. So that needs to be protected. So as I said, I think social media is too open. I think it needs to be shrunk and it needs to be contained so that, a bit like a school, you know, if you've got kids in a school, you may not know everyone, but you know everyone.
Right.
The teachers know who you are. I think from a parental point of view, you've just got to educate your children, and it becomes super important that you allow your children to be open with you. So if you say to a child, you know, if you do this, this is going to happen to you, or, you know, if I find out you've done this, you're going to be grounded for a week, okay? Well, they're not going to tell you the truth, are they? So the most important thing from a parental point of view is to have great communication. Try to be non-judgmental. You can explain to them what they've done and why they shouldn't do it, et cetera, afterwards. But if they're open with you, now you've got a real control on their social media. But if they close shop, what do you do then?
Right.
And that's the problem. So perhaps part of the answer is things that you do outside of the social media, the things that you do within the family. And that, I think, would make a huge difference.
Well, you hit the big communication word there. And I'm very grateful to be able to have these conversations we have, because I value communication very much. What are some of the things that you find that are important in communication, either subtle or maybe not so subtle, that you can do from a parental standpoint that gives your child, your teenager, that trust to stay open with you, even if you haven't made a direct threat? If they know they've peed on the rug, there's still going to be a problem, even if I haven't said so.
Yeah. Well, you teach them right from wrong, aren't you?
Right.
If they've done that and they know they shouldn't have done, then they know they're in the wrong. So open communication is very important, as we've talked about. I think also trying to get them to be less emotional, more logical, you know, more mature. If you can get the maturity into them quicker, It's one of the big problems with teenagers is they're too emotional, too impulsive. Anything can happen. So you just have to teach them. And you teach them, you know, through open conversation, through experience, through nurtured parenting. So there's two types of parenting. There's nurtured parenting, critical parenting. The critical parent says, if you do that, this is going to happen to you. Be careful. You know, don't touch that. You're going to break it. Right. And all this sort of stuff goes on. So you really are installing a program called anxiety into the child. But if you say, you know, you've got this, you can do it. Well done. You try really hard. Well done. Not to the point where they can't do it, you know. And so you develop them. You develop them by nurture parenting. You try to train them to be more logical. You try to get them to look at facts and evidence. You try to stop them guessing and assuming and predicting outcomes. Because it's so easy to guess something, isn't it? It's like if something's happened before, you think it's going to happen again. Or, you know, if you've got two people, let's say you've got two children. One is, say, one's 13 and one's 16. The 13-year-old steals money, okay, and gets caught. So you say, right, you know, you're grounded for a week. I'm taking your phone off you or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then 2 weeks later, more money goes missing. Who do you blame?
Well, it's instinct to think it was the 13-year-old right. again. But we all know that's a fallacy.
Right. And that's the bit you've got to teach them. So then now they're working on evidence. So the truth is you don't know. The reality is it may well be that same child. So the truth is you're going to look into it. You're going to investigate and try and find out, you know, you might see what he did yesterday, what he spent, you know, where he was, who he was with, and try to investigate like that rather than just jump into conclusions, because that's a big problem. That's a problem for everyone, by the way.
You're right. I was going to say, it sounds like you're waving the flag for critical thinking, which seems to be now something that's bubbling up more as like a conversation we can have openly that, boy, it seems like critical thinking is eroding everywhere around us. What do you think the reason why critical thinking has, I hate to couch it in this way, but fallen out of favor?
Well, critical thinking, again, it depends on the family structure, I think. I think people like to live in fantasy world, don't they? You know, if they go on social media, for instance, they look the part. Doesn't mean it's them. And nowadays with AI, of course, they can change anything.
You're right.
And I don't, you know, I think critical thinking is eroded because there's not enough impetus on it. It should be really driven into society. We'd all live much happier lives, you know. And there's, you know, bigger problems such as envy and jealousy and all these types of things that emotional thinking brings. And the other thing with children is to teach them. So rather than wait till they've done something wrong and say, that's it, you know, you shouldn't have done that, you're grounded, you're staying in for a week or 2 weeks. If you let them do it once and then you say to them, okay, just to let you know that if you do that again, this is what's going to happen. Because then when they do it again, you can say, you like being grounded. You wanted to be grounded for 2 weeks, right? They know, no, I didn't. And you say, but you knew what was going to happen. So now you're teaching them responsibility of their actions. So it's different to just critical parenting telling them, you know, it's a much better way of teaching people how to manage themselves and what's going to happen.
Right.
Because then they can take the responsibility on themselves.
A zero tolerance practice doesn't work so well.
No. Well, it's like, you know, if you're too strict with a child, that doesn't work. If you're too easy with a child, that doesn't work. So you have to be in the middle. And one thing I've noticed is, and it's a fact, that people who have less, and I don't mean abused, I mean, when I say deprived, I mean just had less.
Right.
As opposed to kids that have everything, the people that have less, the children that have less, always grow up to do better, happier. So it's really unhealthy to spoil children. I think that's one of the big problems today. Parents just want to give to their children. And I've noticed a lot of parents try to live the life they didn't have through their children. That's a big one, isn't it? So, you know, let's just say that somebody wanted to be a footballer and their son's in the football team. Push, push, push. You know, and the son may not want to do it in the end. It may not just be for him. And this happens a lot. So I think that's something that people should be aware of and guarded against also.
What do you think the motivation is for that vicarious living thing?
Success. You know, people just want success, don't they? People want, You know, people want to be better than other people. But the truth is, no one's better than anyone else.
Right.
Right? People have different skill sets. People have different talents, attributes, and different circumstances. But if you cross it, you know, around through the board, then no, we shouldn't be thinking other people better than us. And this is one of the problems with social media, isn't it? Celebrities. We think they're better than us. If someone said to me, and they do, I love George Clooney. He's such an amazing man. Isn't he fantastic? I would say, I disagree with that because you don't know him. You right. might say, I don't know, he's handsome, or you might say, you know, Julia Roberts is attractive or something, but or Celine Dion's a great singer. But we should value people on the things that we notice about them and not assume that because someone looks good, that they're amazing. Or the opposite, of course, if someone doesn't look good, that they're not amazing.
Do you think that we've hit a new level of cult of personality because of the accessibility of that temptation?
Absolutely. It's made a big difference, hasn't it? So everyone's judging on image these days. Yeah, you know, image is important, but is it that important? You know, it shouldn't be. You should be judged on merit and, you know, on your kindness and your willingness to help others. And but of course, that's just not how it's gone. And again, social media is effectively making a difference to that too.
Do you think that the social media landscape created that situation, or it exacerbated an underlying thing we've always been doing that now it just made it, it just supercharged, it just steroids it?
Oh, absolutely steroids it. I mean, media's always been there, hasn't it? You know, you watch movies, you know. I mean, look how they glamorized smoking,
right,
for instance. And that was been going on since, what, the 40s, giving it to the soldiers when they gave the cigarettes to soldiers.
Smoke on the evening news.
Smoke in the evening, all the big stars. I mean, if you think about it, it's the biggest false advertising. I mean, it's the biggest con in history, isn't it, almost, you know? And then people finally realise and it's changed. And now they've moved on to vaping, haven't they, which is a whole new subject. So I think, but I think social media now is so accessible for everyone. I mean, people have, you know, it's not just one, is it? It's not just Facebook, it's Instagram, it's LinkedIn, it's, you know,
it's TikTok. Everywhere.
And TikTok's another one now, isn't it? That's just exploded. So that problem, I think, has absolutely on steroids.
So I guess that sort of begs the question that I was having this talk with a music artist, and we were talking about how you have, back when I was trained to be an engineer and a producer, they told us we had 15 seconds to get people's attention. As I was recently doing some homework about trying to make better thumbnails for the channel, it told me that I had 0.3 seconds to get someone's attention.
Wow.
Do you think that we're ever going to be able, I shouldn't say ever because that's too long. Do you think that we're at any point, or we have any of the mixings to hit reverse on any of this where we can pay attention to each other longer, whether or not it's a parent-child relationship or an innate or inane social media relationship? Or do you think that we're just going to play lowest common denominator for the foreseeable future here?
I don't see how it can change. I mean, not to say it won't. I mean, perhaps legislation can change things. But if you look at, you know, what's going on in the world, normally it takes a couple of generations for things to change, doesn't it?
Right.
But where's it going? It's the trajectory of it at the moment is definitely heading that way, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so it's just going to become, more and more. And it's an interesting question. It's not a question I've thought about, but how can it change?
Yeah. You know? Do we have any of the seasonings to change this flavor?
Only probably through educating youngsters so it would filter through. But of course, you know, it's like sales, you know, everyone's trying to sell something or everyone's trying to market something. And the tactics that people use for that, as we did with smoking, as it has done with so many things, they just promote it, don't they? They you know, they make a McDonald's burger look like, you know, desirable. So the psychology of advertising is interesting because what happens is they don't say, hey, here's a McDonald's burger advert on TV and expect you to run out and buy one. What happens is it almost hypnotizes you.
Right.
And then when you're hungry, you think, do you know what? I fancy a McDonald's. It's clever. But that's what's been happening for a very, very long time, you know. And then, of course, people are very brand orientated, aren't they? So they want to wear something that's got, you know, Hugo Boss or whatever, you know, on their clothes. So again, it goes back to that people wanting to be better. So I imagine this is different in different cultures, I suspect, but certainly in the Western world now, it's off the chart, isn't it? Everyone wants, you know, the best car, the best, or the best motorcycle, or the biggest house, or, you know.
Yeah, we've created quite a keeping up with the Joneses on a whole new level. Well, I guess that's one of those things that doesn't stand up to too much critical or logical thinking. So that's another reason to try to keep that at bay. Consumerism doesn't equate logically too well.
No.
But the flip side to that coin would be emotional accountability. And a lot of things, a lot of people now, one of the hot button terms has become emotional awareness. When you were speaking before about, you know, being able to keep your emotions in check and such, can you help me or help kind of define the line between having your emotions and still acting not necessarily solely on them? Because I feel like now, thanks to social media and things, not to keep beating that horse, but we are kind of at a point now where people feel some kind of emotional carte blanche. And then this leads to whatever action, being a bully, being a narcissist, whatever the case may be. So do you feel that there are some important things or some ways you can help describe navigating the line between having your emotions and not solely acting on them?
Well, we are emotional creatures, so we're always going to be emotional. But I think that what we have to do is, so our first reaction to an emotion can be a knee-jerk reaction. So we need to be a bit controlled. We need to just pause for a moment and think, okay, what's the truth here? What's the facts here? I mean, if you think about, you know, the government, the military, any business, they don't make emotional decisions. They'd all go bankrupt, wouldn't they?
Right.
They base their decisions on fact. I mean, an insurance company, for instance, look at algorithm. If you buy a sandwich from the store, okay, they haven't just plucked that number out of the sky for the price. That's a calculated price. So really, it's creating a habit form of thinking, okay, so what's the truth here? What are the facts? Okay, what's the right thing to do here? And I think that anybody's capable of that if they're trained, if they're taught. And it's a practice. It's like anything, isn't it?
What do you think the crux of that is?
I think that's just about, again, it's down to good parenting. That's good down to education in schools. I think schools could play a massive part in all the things we've actually discussed so far. Schools have the monopoly, don't they? They have the attention. But now, of course, everyone's homeschooling. So that's a problem.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think it's a problem as much as it's got its, don't get me wrong, it's got its positives.
Right.
Because there's a lot missing in schools. But it doesn't have, now you're just understanding two people, your parents. That's it. So it's a very biased life. And, you know, so you're missing out on, again, the social interaction with others, the diversity of learning.
What do you think about the people that do, like, I don't know how common it is in the UK, but here we have a lot of, it's almost become like a hybrid situation where a few days a week you're, you know, in your home setting and a few days a week you're in a group with other homeschool kids. So they've tried to mitigate that obvious downside that you're speaking of. Do you think that there's a halfway ground or it's really like a on or off switch thing?
I think it's dependent. I think some people need more social interaction. Some people don't.
Right.
I think it depends on, you know, the views of the parents, what they think is important. But I think, you know, thing in schools, I think they've got a lot of things wrong too.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, so I think it's, we're not going to know, are we, for another 20 years.
It's the same one of those things. Do you feel that we're uniquely at a point where we have a bunch of things that are going to take a couple generations to shake out? Or do you think that's always the case and we're just hyper aware of it right now?
I think that we don't really know. It's like, it's a bit like saying we know the pitfalls of smoking, right?
Yeah.
But nobody knows the pitfalls of vape. And because there's no real evidence. Getting back to the facts and evidence again. So it's about, you have to wait and see, don't you? You have to look at the results. You know, it's a scientific approach. if you have to wait for the results before you can conclude what it was and what you can do. So it's tricky, isn't it? It's tricky, you know. I mean, I think homeschooling can be a great thing. You know, if you've got, again, if you've got the parents, the right sort of parents, the parents that want to, are able to sit down with you. I don't know, some of it's online, isn't it? But again, there's no accountability. I've got a friend whose child's homeschooling. I mean, she's up to midnight every night. You know, she's claiming she does her work in 3 hours. She's a bright girl. But what implications is that going to have when she gets older?
Right.
Who knows?
Exactly. I was going to say, you won't know. You can't know.
No.
So then how, I guess that begs the question then, how do you navigate what is always the unknowable when you're trying to have some best interest in mind for said unknowable?
I think you just got to have a core infrastructure for it. You know, you've got to say, well, what's important for us, for these children is, you know, to learn to be logical, you know, to be kind, to be hardworking. You know, I think kids doing chores is very important. You know, it's all part of their growing up, isn't it? Because if they don't do chores growing up, they end up lazy as adults. So, you know, there's a lot of things. I actually think that homeschooling, you know, there should be a structure to it. There should be an infrastructure that everyone uses. And what do we want for the future? You know, we want children to work hard. We want children to be honest. We want them to have a moral compass. We want them to, you know, to value other people and value their health or, you know, whatever it is. There are core things that human beings need, aren't there? And if we don't, you know, for instance, if you don't look after your health, you know, you get it old, you lose the mobility. If you eat rubbish all the time, you know, if you go around disrespecting people. Because the one thing that we are, all of us are, is we're just mirrors of our own behaviours. We're a reflection. If you've got some, you know, 18-year-old walking down the street, swag on his shoulders, acting the tough guy, well, he's reflecting aggression. So he's going to attract negative energy for sure and hang around with other people like that.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if the Buddhist monk's walking down the street practicing, you know, love and kindness, what's he attracting? So a lot of things children should be taught is how they attract good things, and adults too, by the way. Do good, get good. It doesn't always feel like it works that way, but it really does. You know, if you're out there, you know, committing crimes, you know, you're going to have something that's going to happen to you. It's as simple as, if you're out there, you know, treating people in a bad way, well, you're not going to have any friends. So, you know, and I think the other problem today is we ought to be very careful because we're developing a lot of narcissists.
That's why I mentioned that.
Absolutely. That's a problem, a big problem, because they don't care about other people. And that's really caused by spoiling children and valuing them on their achievements rather than valuing them on who they are, their kindness, their empathy, you know, all the things that they need to have to make them good adults.
Right. And I couldn't agree more. Part of me wonders if you at all feel that this narcissism thing is almost like a cheat code protectionist way to try to supplant building actual confidence and self-assuredness.
I'm sure there's an aspect to that. Again, I think social media is responsible for this too. And everyone wants to be better. So, you know, if children are not taught empathy, you know, teach them to smooth pets, you know, to pet dogs and cats and, you know, to love animals and to value kindness. But that's eroding, isn't it? And that's kind of what you were talking about just now. It's just eroding from society. That needs to be brought back in. So that could be part of a structure for schooling, for homeschooling. And in terms of, you know, hiding behind the mask of narcissism, well, that's because of expectation. And everyone has these high expectations. And if you feel like, if you're insecure, then you're more likely to boast and to act secure. You know, right. Sort of fake it to make it. But that's, I understand that psychology on that thought pattern. But if you're not doing the work, you won't get the result. So people have to work on themselves.
Well, that's funny you should say that. I just watched a video by a famous rapper called Redman.
Okay.
And Redman was saying that part of the problem is we don't know how to heal ourselves anymore because social media only shows the person at the beginning and the person at the end, never what it took to get there. Do you find any of that to be the case?
I think that's very, very true. If you see a comedian, okay, you don't see all the clubs he's worked, all the abuse he's had over the years to get to where he is. A music band, you haven't seen all the times that they're gigging in pubs and bars and busking on the streets. And people don't see that. So therefore, what we're saying is people are not recognizing the effort and the hard work that's required.
Exactly.
And that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Right.
People want quick fix, instant fix, want it now. You know, now we've got, you know, now you can just order an Uber, you can order food, you can order anything you want. So that's all part of it as well, isn't it? Everything now, quick fix society. Well, any quick fix doesn't last long. So it you know, if you don't have that inner security, I don't think you're ever going to be happy or content. So that's, again, something that needs to be ingrained into youngsters. It's part of what I do, actually. I think it's very important. It's very important to develop self-trust, self-acceptance, self-value, self-belief, self-confidence, self-assurance, and self-esteem. And so you have to, you know, teach children and youngsters and adults, all of us. It's what we say to ourselves, isn't it? It's important. It's how we manage our inner dialogue. And how we learn to look through the lines. If you look at sport, you know, they teach, certainly in football or soccer, should I say here, they teach the young players to read between the lines, to get between the players to get the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of a very good metaphor for what we should be doing. We should be looking around the edges rather than just looking directly at the target.
It seems like there's like an ebb and flow of that societally. Like we used to collectively more look at the edges. And do you feel like this is just an ebb and flow thing?
I think people are not interested in how things are around the edges. I mean, for instance, if you buy a KFC or buy a can of Coke, do you know what's in it? Do you care?
Some
do, some
don't. If
you buy a car, do you know how it's all put together? Do you care? No. And people don't care. People are not interested anymore. And so people just want the goods, the item, the fix, the winning, you know, the praise, the glory. And yeah, but the fact is that the people that do get what they want in life, they are putting the work in. They know that. And, you know, in life, you know, life is a marathon, not a sprint.
Mm.
So time tells a story. But if you don't teach children that, how do they know? You don't teach people.
Right. Well, it used to be that you could, your life as a parent in the times forced you to exemplify it.
Mm.
Now we're all living in a world where you don't necessarily have to exemplify doing the work because we can Uber and do all the things. So what do you think are some of the steps of trying to exemplify a life worth working for?
Well, I think everything comes with a price and a prize. So ask the question, what's the prize and what's the price?
Hmm.
You know, if you want to go from your car to your office and get takeaways, well, the prize is that your life is pretty easy. But the price is your health will suffer. You know, there's a lot of things that can happen. So, and everything. So I think that's a really important thing to think about with everything. What's the price and what's the prize?
Yeah,
two simple questions.
I like that.
Mm.
So I want to circle back just a little bit. Before you were saying we all ultimately end up in a spot where, for whatever reason, we fight the temptation to want to be better or want to see ourselves as better or maybe the worst case scenario is we see someone and then feel bad about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
What's the operative point to not wanting to engage in this rat race of wanting to be better than, but still engaging in some kind of race within your own walls of being the best you can be?
So that's about your self-esteem, your self-confidence. And if you can get to a point where you don't need, but you don't need. So I've had someone come to me in the past and say, I'm looking for someone that's always there for me. Somebody that would never let me down, my confidant, you know, someone I could trust. Wouldn't it be amazing if I could find someone, because I broke up with my wife and I felt so lonely. And I said to the chap, Have you looked in the mirror? The truth is, all of us have the innate ability to be fulfilled and to develop self-love, self-trust, self-acceptance. And that just comes from, you know, focusing on working on yourself and not trying to emulate others, not trying to copy others, not trying to be something you're not, being honest with yourself and building on yourself. And it's a work of art. It's a progression.
Well, for a lot of people, that's quite frightening. How do you get off the blocks of doing that for the people that are like, oh my God, I don't want to be scared that I'm at square one right now?
Do you think that's frightening?
I personally don't. I enjoy square one.
Yeah.
But that's partly because I've crossed people in my life that aren't like me that I've come to recognize that.
It's you know, if people say to you, you know, you should always exercise, look after yourself, eat healthily. Right? That's the common thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But people don't do that with their minds. It's you have to work at it. Everything starts at step one, doesn't it? There is no quick jumps. You know, anything that comes fast will go fast. So it's worth doing. And I don't think it's anything that people should be frightened of. I think it's something that people should embrace. Mm. People should say, hey, I want to feel content within. I want to have the best life. And I don't want to be at the mercy of everyone else and be affected by everyone else, be affected by what they're saying about me. Or because the truth is, as I said, people reflect their own feelings. They're going to say what they want. And if we're affected by everything, that's all comes down to our insecurity.
So when we're talking about teenagers, especially, not that it's unique to them, but do you feel that it's like you have to hit a rock bottom of I'm not taking any of this anymore to make that 180? I mean, because not everybody will be afforded the incremental teachings that would give them the abilities to stand up to that as it comes. What do you think is the operative point to being able to make that 180 where I think I might feel like shit about myself to, hey, I'm a hell of a person?
Well, I think it's self-talk, affirmation. If you think of your self-esteem as a muscle, if you want to build your arms, you get the dumbbells out, you know? If you want to build your self-esteem, you do it with words. Words are the weights that build the muscles that become confidence, self-esteem. So they have to obviously know that. If you don't know that, but we could say ignorance is everywhere, isn't it? So, you know, stand in the mirror, talk to yourself, tell yourself positive things. Now, initially, you may not believe it. Obviously, it's quite common for people that are feeling negative to say something and think that's not true. But ultimately, there are millions of things that are not true. Everything's a perception, isn't it? You know, different cultures have different beliefs. Different people have different beliefs. So you are what you tell yourself you are. If you're going to tell yourself, and people get very much insecure and negative because they're practicing it. They're getting good at it.
Right.
I'm like, you've been practicing this for 10 years. No wonder you feel the way you do. So change it. Stand in the mirror. Give yourself positive affirmations. I use 4 affirmations on every client I see for the first time, and I ask them to do it in the mirror. So connecting with yourself. So the other thing is that we're all connected to an image, but the truth is that's not who we are. We are our souls. Agreed? Some people call it an inner self or a consciousness or a spirit, but we are souls occupying bodies, vessels. And we have to connect to those souls to gain what you're saying people don't have. So one of the things I always do, I get them to go in the mirror. I ask them to get about 6 inches away from their own eyes and just introduce themselves. Say, hey, Eric, it's nice to meet you, right? People feel weird. You're on your own. It doesn't matter. Some people are emotional, I imagine.
Right.
But you introduce yourself. You come back off the mirror and you say, I fear nothing. I fear no one. I can handle any situation. My best is always good enough. You say it 10 times, but you say it with conviction. You know, you fear nothing, you fear no one. Do that morning and night. And then, so eventually you learn to self-counsel. If you connect really well with yourself, I mean, people must think I'm strange walking down the street talking to myself without a cell phone in my hand, right? But I vent, you know, I release my feelings. I talk, I self-counsel. And I think it's critical. And these are the things that people need to learn rather than taking advice. I mean, look, if you wanted legal advice, you wouldn't go to an accountant. You'd go to a lawyer. If you wanted financial advice, you wouldn't go to a lawyer. So people are taking advice, like, you know, somebody's taken marriage advice from their mate who has been divorced three times. Right?
He seems reliable. He's had experience.
He's my friend. Yeah. I trust him.
Yeah. He's been through it a couple of times.
Yeah. So, you know, you've got to do it in the right way. So learning self-counsel, you know, so you reflect on your feelings. Another really good thing to do if you're not sure what to do about a situation is to visualize your best friend is in that position. Okay? Because if you think about it, you know the situation because you're in it. You care about your friend. You want the best for him or her. So that's normally 99% right. What would you advise your best friend to do in this situation?
Well, do you feel like that's because that's an exercise that makes it easy to divorce yourself from your immediate emotions?
Well, everyone's looking for escapism. You know, this is the problem. One of the things I've realized is that people that are very insecure, they are more likely to self-sabotage, self-hatred, and just self-destruct. And so, you know, anyone who, if you value yourself, right, you're more cautious in everything you do. And you're more thoughtful, more pensive about what you're doing. So, yeah, it's really just learning to value yourself. I think that's so important.
We've had a couple other people on the show that have gone so far as to say on the line that you were just on that, you're not your thoughts, you're not your emotions, you're just kind of this, for want of a better way of putting it, conscientious objector with some type of ability to put your thumb on the scale. Do you liken your framework to that, or do you feel some of your, just to keep on the parlance, we're using some of your soul's connection to those things? You are connected to your thoughts. You are connected to your feelings.
Well, if you think, the way our minds work, there are just lots of options running around. Okay. I heard a lovely line. It was like someone said, someone was accusing someone of always changing their mind. And the other person said, well, you know, what's the point in having a mind if you can't change it, right?
That's fair.
It's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we learn by experience. That's another thing most of us, or a lot of people do. They have to learn by their own mistakes. They don't look at someone else and think, well, you did that, so I'm doing this. That doesn't happen, does it?
No.
But I think I think that, you know, we have all these options running around in our mind, and we don't know how to choose the right ones. A lot of the time. So you have to take your time, you have to think about it, you have to think. I've created thinking rules. It's one of my new books.
I was just going to say, yeah. I want to dovetail into the books, and I know one of them is on this line, so let's do that.
Yeah,
now
no,
tell
absolutely.
Me about that book.
So it's based on a premise of three things. So I did slightly talk to you about this last time, but I thought about it more, and I've gone a bit further with it, and I've created a book called Three Steps to Sanity. And I realized actually that our mental health is really quite simplistic. It really is. Number one, you know, do you have a guide to manage your thoughts? So if we have thinking rules, like you have rules on the roads, rules at home, rules in the family, rules at schools, rules at college, everywhere you go, rules. Mm-hmm. So if we have some thinking rules to guide us, now we don't have to worry about all these options, do we? So, you know, we let go of the things that we're not in control of, we're powerless to.
Stoicism, baby.
Sorry?
Stoicism, baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And because that's a big deal, isn't it, for most people, they're trying to control things that they can't control, you know, the flow of life. You can only go one way on a surfboard. Coming off, right?
That's a great one.
Right?
Love that.
Yeah, and I've got 12. I won't go into all of them, but I've, you know, looking at facts, evidence, truth, and proof. Accepting who you are and what you are and where you are. Having your expectations real. I mean, have you ever met anyone that can do better than their best?
Why do you think we live in such a time of distortion, self-distorted expectations?
It's just that there's just an inconsistent level of belief and education, and different people have different beliefs. We're all our peers affect us massively. Our cultures, there's a combination of things, I think, that affect that. So anyway, so creating thinking rules. Second area is the relationship you have with yourself. The third area is just trauma. If you've had lots of trauma, that needs to be cleared. I do a practice called hypnoanalysis. It's not widely known. It's so effective. Releasing those emotions, releasing and forgiving. Forgive yourself.
Tell me about how that kind of goes. Start.
Well, you can't change the past. You can't change what's happened, but you can change yourself. You can change yourself with a simple decision. I want to change. But guilt is a big problem. Guilt and shame is a massive problem out there. And guilt has, it's one of those things that it's doesn't serve any purpose, does it, guilt? What it means to me is if you feel guilty about something, then tells me you're a good person, okay? You care, all right? I'd be much more concerned with someone who didn't give a damn. Somebody's like, oh, I don't feel guilty. I don't, you know, it's a narcissistic approach, isn't it?
Mm.
So I think it's important to acknowledge guilt, but not to let it destroy you. So, you know, you have to let go of the past. You have to forgive yourself. You have to, you know, let yourself heal. Otherwise, you'll never get over it. And you must say that for every negative thing that's happened, something positive's come from it. A positive learning will have come from it. I had a client who'd been sexually abused as a child from her uncle. Horrendous, right? Absolutely horrendous. And I said to her, so what positive learning have you had from that? Because I wanted her to forgive him because it was eating at her.
Right.
Not him.
Right.
And she said, how can I have a positive learning from that? Are you kidding me? And I said, well, think about it. And she thought about it for a bit. She said, you know, actually, she said, I protected all my three of my children. I made sure that they're always safe. So the positive learning arrived. And there is that in everything, absolutely everything. So when the problem is if we don't forgive others or forgive ourselves, it's one thing forgiving others, people know about that. But what about forgiving ourselves? If we don't do that, how can we move on? You know, are we accountable forever for a mistake we've made in the past? So, and forgiving others, I always remember I wrote something years ago now, and I said to all those people that have hurt me, that have broken my heart, that have done me wrong, I forgive you all and I release you with love. P.S. Don't call me. Right?
Yeah.
Don't call me.
Yeah.
I'm not forgiving you so you can be back in my life. I'm forgiving you because I don't want to walk around feeling the emotions that that brings.
Right.
So inwardly, if you're not forgiving yourself, it's affecting you. It's affecting your behavior. How can you change if you don't do that? You know, okay, we can all repent. We all can make good. So do something good. You know, give and you will receive, you know? And make it into something positive. Make it into something that gives you a better life, gives other people a better life. Because you hear amazing stories. I heard an amazing story about a guy murdered someone's son, and he was a priest. I don't really call them here, not priests, but there's another word, reverend or something. Anyway, and he forgave the murderer. I thought, wow, isn't that's powerful.
Right.
That's powerful. But he didn't do it for him. He did it for himself, didn't he? Because he didn't want to walk around with the pain. And every story's got a story. You know, perhaps it happened, you know, everyone plays a part in a situation. You know, it's like if you've got two people together married happy, all lovey-dovey, and they break up in 3 to 4 years' time, and the wife says, well, you know, I'm divorcing the husband. I've divorced him. He had an affair. Well, how about why did he have an affair? What happened? It was going well. What changed? So that's another thing. We have to take accountability for our actions. We have to notice that we can't just blame others for everything.
Yeah, we are in
people share the blame.
We are in sort of an epidemic of accountability and culpability. Mm. What do you think attributes to that?
Well, you know, it's just people like to be exempt from feeling persecuted, feeling blamed, you know, from the responsibility that it brings. So I've written another book called Freedom Starts Here.
That's the one
for prisoners.
Yes, that's the one I'm most curious about.
Yes. Okay, so I had a client come to me. So a lady calls me and says, hey, can you help my son, my son-in-law, because he's on day release from prison. His grandmother who brought him up has died. His mother's riddled with cancer. He's in terrible state. Can you help him? So I said, yeah, of course I can. So I arranged to see him the next time he came out. In fact, I spoke to him on the phone there and then. And he came to me and I realized that, you know, there is no mental health in prison. You're given a Bible, right? Nothing wrong with that. But how's that going to rehabilitate them? And so I thought with my other book, Three Steps to Sanity, which is to simplify mental health, the simple three areas,
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, I wonder if I could incorporate that in a book for prisoners to help them. And I don't condone prisoners. You know, if you commit crimes, then you're in prison for a reason.
Right.
But what about the family? What about the victims? What about the children repeating the behavior? And so I have this idea to write this book to try and to do that, plus help them in prison, because that's obviously affects everyone else. And, you know, and if you could get their mental health improved, wouldn't that change, again, change generations, change the pattern of thinking? So I'm actually creating a GoFundMe page to try and take donations to provide every prisoner with a free copy of the book. That would be my dream.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing, you know, and I'm looking to do that very much. It's something that's very important to me. Because if you've got more people doing these sort of things, you know, we could become victims of crime in the future, couldn't we? So, you know, we're saving so many people, changing destinies, changing family patterns, just through really what is simple education that they never had.
Why do you think that's the case?
What, sorry, what?
Why they've never had the education? Why we're at this point where we don't teach these things?
They're not taught, are they? If, you know, if your parents act a certain way.
Well, I guess my question kind of presupposes that there was a time when we did teach these things. If that is the case, how come, what do you think attributes to the fact that we're in a time now where we don't teach those things?
Well, people want more. People want to be better. You know, if you go to a culture where everyone's the same, whether it's Africa or Cuba, you'll notice that there's less crime because there's no competition. It's like somebody doesn't have, everyone has the same.
Right.
That'd be nothing. It doesn't matter what it is. If everyone's got the same, there's no envy, there's no competition, it changes. So we live in a society, a competitive society, where people are getting more, as we said, so they want more. And a lot of people aren't in a position to get more. So how are they going to get it? So then they get it easily. People, and also, you know, if you're not taught empathy, if you're not taught to have a moral compass as a child, all these things, you know, and that's what happens. So really, I think that comes down to love in the family. I think if you show children love and kindness, that makes a huge difference. But, you know, if we've got these stereotypes, you know, I'm the big tough dad and, you know, and the mum's, you know, sort of just subservient. But back in the day, of course, people would gather around the fire and talk and eat, and they would, you know, play the piano at home in the evenings. But now that's not happening, is it? The kids are in the bedroom doing their own thing. The mum's working, the dad's working, you know, so there's been a change, a massive change in family structure, and it's not there anymore. And also, if you've got someone who is dishonest as your role model, how's that going to work out? Because effectively, they're going to lead you to believe that it's okay to be like that.
Well, now we're, I guess that's where you creep in, trying to act like there's a subjective nature of honesty.
Mm. Absolutely. And so, you know, so the book is absolutely geared to try to change that. And it'd be a wonderful thing, wouldn't it? It's not going to change everyone. Of course not. That's not going to happen. But if it changes everyone a little bit, if it changes a lot of people, you know, a proportion of them, then that's great. You know,
we got to find some Gideons to partner up with. They're really good at getting books in places.
What are Gideons?
They leave the Bibles in hotels.
Oh, I see. Yeah absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Whenever you see it says this Bible was placed here by a Gideon.
Right.
But no one's ever seen a Gideon. I don't know what they are. It's like they're more elusive than leprechauns, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're really good at getting books places.
No, actually, I'm here. I'm staying in a place. I saw a Bible there, actually. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
See if you can catch a Gideon. Yeah, you got to put up like a trail cam and see if you can empty out the drawer, put up a trail cam, and see when one comes back.
Absolutely.
So the third book I just want to touch on as we're getting closer to the end here. Uh-huh. The third book was one that dovetails in more with your app, right?
Yes, correct. Yes, you've done your homework, haven't you?
A bit.
So it's called A Parent's Guide to Understanding Teenagers. Again, parents don't know what to do when kids become teenagers. You know,
teenagers don't know what to do when they become
exactly.
teenagers.
No,
so
one knows. No one knows what to do. So I created a book. It's actually I have a free ebook on the website for the app. So I'm giving away it's a mini version of it. But the full version is really just looking at you know, all the things that children need help with, all the things that parents need to understand. Like, for instance, you know, we didn't have cyberbullying when I was young, so it's likely if there's older parents, they don't know what that is either.
Mm.
So there's, you know, there's a social media issue. There's so many factors. And so I decided I would write this guide to help people manage their children. So, you know, if I can make little changes along the way or help people make changes in their teenagers and go on to have better lives, then great.
What are some of the things that you've noticed in the things that you've tried to do to people that are for people, rather, I should say, that have really gravitated towards them, really helped them? What are some of the things that you're finding help make these little dents?
Just you know, again, developing relationships with self, you know, learning how to manage your emotions.
Are there like some small, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I mean, are there like some small day-to-day practices, especially in the parent-teenager relationship, beyond, you know, the positive affirmations or things like that, but maybe some little things that in aggregate make a big difference that maybe people are just blind to because it seems too little?
I mean, communication, again, isn't it? Communication is huge. You know, when I was growing up, you know, it was elbows off the table, no talking at the table.
Yeah.
All this was going on. It was very, you know, very stoic, wasn't it? These days, you know, kids are in their bedrooms having dinner. They're watching TV with dinners on their lap. So that, you know, there's things that could happen, isn't there? You've got to, you know, it's one thing saying I'm going to communicate with the children, but how about how are you going to do it? Where are you going to do it?
Right.
Where are you going to get these opportunities? So, you know, mealtime is probably a really important factor, isn't it? To eat round a table, an opportunity to openly talk and discuss things. The thing is with children is they clam up a lot and they withdraw. It's one of the features of the app is an advice line.
Mm.
So it's an advice line. I mean, the app's, it's like, you know, like $5 a month for everything. So there's an advice line. So if they're stuck and they don't know what to do, they've got an outlet, someone to ask. It'd be me or someone like me. Will answer their questions. But if you can develop the open communication with the children at a young age, that changes. So there's taboo subjects, isn't it? Isn't there? You know, if some of those want to talk about sex, or, you know, they want to talk about what happened to them at school or what they're fearful of. And of course, there's a lot of bravado with teenagers. They're all acting like nothing affects them, nothing. But we need to let them know that it's okay. And that doesn't, you know, it's okay to have an emotion. But share it so someone can educate you and how to change that or how to deal with it.
Well, when we live in such a world now that's so much of its foundation is being built on bravado, like things like that, how do you help people, regardless if they're adolescents or adults, have enough vulnerability to do that kind of self-examination without having to feel like this is weakness?
Well, the thing is, just got to get real. You know, I think you've got to be who you are. You know, you can't be someone else. So you've got to be comfortable with who you are and what you are. You know, everyone's got limitations. People have all kinds of issues, don't they? People have impairments. People have, you know, other problems. But you've just got to figure out what your foundation is and who you are and then work to improve it. You can't just be it. And I think so it really comes down to a lot of self-honesty, but not critical self-honesty. It's got to be positive self-honesty. But, you know, if you're honest about where you are and who you are, you can get changed, can't you? You know, if you're someone that's not very good at sport, for instance, you know, and you're at school and all the girls love the captain of the football team, right? And you're the person that doesn't, you know, doesn't shine at that age. Well, I would say to that child, well, that's okay, because you will shine at something else. Work on what you're good at, focus on your talents, and the rest will come on its own. You know, that person may be like fantastic at math, you know, and then 20 years down the road, the captain of the football team is just, you know, working in a local store, and that person at math is doing fantastic in their career. And so you never know, what's going to happen, but it's really just about self-improvement, isn't it? Working with your own strengths, not trying to be upset or jealous about other people's strengths, and understanding that everything is temporary. Everything changes. And if you want to make a change, make one. Do something. work your strengths, which is what we do, right?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, that's the thing. I guess the real operative bit is how to be comfortable in your own skin.
Yes. And it, you know, it's a lot of acceptance, isn't it? The thing is with acceptance is if we don't accept things, we get frustrated. We get angry. Why is this happening to me? Why am I like this? Why? And now we're frustrated. And that's not going to solve anything. But if we accept something, we become solution-based. We're like, so what can I do about it? What should I do? Now, you know, one of the things that when clients come to me, and they may have suffered for years and years and years in certain issues, but they've developed acceptance. They've accepted they've got a problem and they reach out for help. So it's one of those things which is a bit underrated, actually. You know, we have to accept who we are. You know, someone, but the thing is, it's you know, someone's got dark eyes, they want blue eyes. They've got dark hair, they want blonde hair. You know, they're small, they want to be tall. Where does it end? We have to accept who we are, where we are, what we've got, and then figure out how we can improve on that, how we can make our limitations or our gifts, our strengths better, improve what we've got. Practice and patience, right?
Yeah, well, that sounds like one of the things that's our cornerstone around here, and that's empowerment. It sounds like this is personal empowerment. So instead of asking you a loaded one and then a fun one, I'm going to do a combo platter here. Your last one is kind of a loaded fun one. For those that don't have that self-assuredness, for those that maybe are at square one, still feeling guilty, still feeling shame, still feeling less than for whatever reason, I couldn't agree with you more that that empowerment is the way out of that. If you could tell that person or those people, if you had one one-liner or whatever it is to get through to them that says it's okay to start, what is that bit of momentum?
I would say you are all you've got, right? So accept that you are all you've got. And if there's an issue, reach out, get help, educate yourself, learn, change. You know, recognize that life is changing for everyone all the time. And that's how it is. And what you do, and the other thing I would say to them is, it's not about tomorrow. There isn't any tomorrow, okay? Tomorrow doesn't exist right now. If you want something tomorrow, you do it today. If you want to lose weight tomorrow, you diet today. If you want to become qualified at something, you study today. So I think being in the present moment is super important. So I would say this is all you've got. This is the present moment. And what you do today is what's going to happen to you tomorrow. And be patient, because, you know, everyone's looking for happiness. But actually, the truth is, happiness is moments.
Right.
We don't just walk around with this amazing
just happiness, and I'm just covered in happiness.
So happy, yeah. Right? We walk around saying, you know, wanting more, striving for more. I think everyone does to a degree. And so we've got to be content. So we've got to be content where we are and say, I mean, for instance, would I like my books to be a bestseller? Of course. Would I like every prisoner to have my book? Absolutely. Has that happened? No. Am I going to sit here and cry about it? No. I'm going to work towards it. And I'm going to see if I can make that happen. You know, you could have four people go to a football academy and, you know, and they've all got the potential to become professional footballers. Okay.
Right. Yep.
But one falls out because of injury, right? One of them, you know, makes it, it's just ordinary. The other one just doesn't get selected, and the other one becomes Tom Brady. I mean, that's just life. So what's meant for you doesn't pass you by. I believe that. If something magnificent, significant is meant for you, it won't pass you by. But what we do along the way and how we play our lives comes down to how much effort we put in.
Amen
right?
to that.
That's what I think.
What's meant for you won't pass you by. I love that one.
Yeah. If big things.
Love it. Well, Mr. Ivan, I can't thank you enough for sending that email, coming back. You have always got a home here, my friend.
Thank
I'm
you so much.
Grateful to hear from you, and I appreciate your insight very much. Thank
Amazing.
You, sir.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank
Love
you, Eric.
It. Thank you, man.
Yes.